Hello and welcome to today's episode. I will be speaking to Dr. Alexander Sweetman on comorbid insomnia and sleep apnea. Dr. Sweetman, please tell us about yourself.
Hi, thanks for the chat, David. So I'm Alex. I'm a senior program manager with the Australasian Sleep Association, which is the peak sleep science, education, information and advocacy body operating mainly in Australia and New Zealand. So we have about 1,000 members with lots of diverse interests in all things sleep health and sleep medicine. So I'm coordinating a primary care education and implementation program at the moment, running for the next 18 months or so, to try and improve the identification and management of sleep problems and sleep disorders throughout primary care in lots and lots of different ways. Yeah, so thanks again for the talk today.
This is the Clinical Takeaway podcast from Health Ed, where we interview leading medical experts on important topics that can positively change the way you practice. Here's your host, GP and medical educator, Dr. David Lim.
Alex, we're going to look at a very interesting topic. We're going to look at comorbid insomnia and sleep apnea. Look, we've covered insomnia, sleep apnea. People have mentioned in passing these two occurring together. But today, hopefully, we're going to get a deeper dive into it. So the first and simple question, how common is it to have both insomnia and untreated sleep apnea?
A lot more common than people initially think is the short answer. So historically, insomnia and sleep apnea have been seen as completely separate conditions, mostly expecting that they occur in isolation. But since about 1970, when the combination of insomnia and sleep apnea was first identified, there's been more and more research gradually coming out. And now there's actually a huge amount of research to say that really, really frequently they co-occur. So the prevalence estimates, about 30 to 40% of people with insomnia also have obstructive sleep apnea when tested on an overnight sleep study. And about 30 to 50% of people with sleep apnea also report insomnia symptoms. So that's depending on the denominator, the prevalence is slightly different. In the general population, we think that translates to about 5 to 10% of Australian adults. So very prevalent for people to have both conditions at the same time.
That's crazy. That really is huge numbers, Alex.
Really high prevalence for two conditions that are really oftenly seen as completely separate and occurring independently of each other. That's right.
Which is the chicken, which is the egg?
Yeah, we don't know. I would love to be able to give you a straightforward answer to that. We think it's different for different patients, and we're working really hard, researchers and clinicians both in Australia and internationally. We're working really hard to try and identify which presentations and which sort of constellations of different symptoms might indicate to us in which people the insomnia is causing the sleep apnea or contributing to, and in which people the sleep apnea is causing or contributing to the insomnia. And a lot of people, we think, probably have both conditions that are actually bi-directionally related over time. So both are the chicken and both are the egg over time, regardless of which came first.
That's crazy, isn't it? But here's a question. We know that chronic insomnia has incredible impacts on our health, both mentally and physically. And we know that sleep apnea, untreated, also has significant impacts on our health. What happens when you've got two significant sleep issues occurring together? How does that impact our health?
Yeah, I guess you're exactly right. Both insomnia and sleep apnea independently, when they're not treated, do have pretty profound impacts on our mental health, physical health, and overall quality of life. And I guess it's unsurprising that when we put them together, some of those effects are compounded or that there's worse outcomes. So we know that people with COMESA generally have worse sleep. So whether it's sleep quality, quantity, whether it's assessed subjectively or via self-report, or whether it's assessed objectively, like with a sleep study, generally people with comorbid insomnia and sleep apnea have worse sleep overall compared to people with neither condition. and often compared to those with either insomnia alone or compared to people with sleep apnea alone. There's also quite a bit of evidence suggesting that people with both conditions might have worse mental health as well, so symptoms of depression and maybe anxiety, potentially higher prevalence of cardiovascular disease. And over the last few years, our group at the Adelaide Institute for Sleep Health as well have published three different studies in large population-based samples, which have consistently found that people with both insomnia and sleep apnea have a higher risk of mortality over the next 10 to 20 years or so compared to people with neither condition. So we think those effects of COMISA on mental health, physical health, and some of the treatment implications we can talk about might lead to higher risk of mortality over time as well. So fairly concerning consequences overall, David.
I have thoughts in my mind about people who drive large commercial vehicles, your Uber drivers and electricians who have both, sleep apnea and insomnia. What are the implications to them, and what are the legal implications to us as GPs?
For all patients with a suspicion of insomnia or sleep apnea or both, I think GPs have a really important role to play in identifying those patients, doing some of the screening, including assessment of different lifestyle and occupation risk factors that might come into play, and then referring appropriately to sleep physicians or to sleep studies or whatever the appropriate management approach might be. We know that untreated sleep apnea is a risk factor for motor vehicle accidents. It's often associated with daytime sleepiness, lethargy, attention lapses, and so on. In a patient with both insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea that's working one of those potentially high-risk occupations, it's probably a suitable scenario for a referral to a specialist sleep and respiratory physician. But access to treatment. So, we know that some treatments for sleep apnea really reduce those symptoms of symptoms of sleepiness and accident risk. And it's important for those high-risk occupations to get these patients onto treatment quite quickly if possible.
Now, we have had many interviews with regard to insomnia, and we've been told that the most effective treatment for insomnia is in fact a referral to a good sleep psychologist, but there are not many of them around.
Correct.
We had never been also told that in anybody with insomnia, we should really seriously consider doing a sleep study, seeing so many of them have both. So the difficulty is, Alex, you've told us that you don't yet have a good way of helping GPs identify those who have primarily an insomnia issue or primarily OSA issue. So what should a GP do if somebody comes in complaining of insomnia and you suspect just by looking at them and the way they are, the largeness, the tired look? It could be from insomnia, they're obese, it could be sleep apnea. What should we do?
Sure, yeah. So we don't have the evidence in our research studies yet to guide exactly which sequence or order of treatments should come first for people with COMISA. So the overall recommendation at the moment is that if both insomnia and sleep apnea are suspected, the recommendation is to assess for both. So treat it like someone has both conditions rather than attribute one as the secondary and one as the primary condition. In addition to assessing both, potentially diagnosing both, providing access to treatments for both the insomnia and the obstructive sleep apnea is the current recommendation. So in that situation, that example that you outlined, if a patient comes in to see their general practitioner reporting symptoms of insomnia, but based on the phenotype presentation, the anthropometrics, et cetera, if there's a suspicion of sleep apnea. So there's really good screening tools that general practitioners can use, self-report screening tools that can assess for a higher risk of sleep apnea. So two of these are available, commonly used, are the OSA 50 and also the Stop Bang questionnaire. And in addition, to the Epworth Sleepiness Scale, a subjective measure of someone's feelings of sleepiness during the day. The combination of these different questionnaires can be used by a GP to actually refer a patient directly for a sleep study. So rather than going through the sleep physician for a sleep study, a GP can use the OSA50 and stop bang in addition to the Epworth Sleepiness Scale and refer patients for a sleep study. So the short answer is yes, it's important to identify and manage and also provide access to diagnosis and treatment of both conditions if there's a suspicion of both.
We'll come to treatment later. I just want to look at lifestyle issues with you now. You know, issues such as, I'll just name them to start with, weight loss, alcohol, the role of various medications, including hypnotics, on both insomnia and sleep apnea. So how do we walk through this quite complex field?
Yeah, sure. So where should we start?
Let's start with weight loss.
Weight loss, yeah. So not as much literature looking at weight and insomnia associations, but obviously a lot of literature looking at associations between weight and obstructive sleep apnea. And there's good evidence to show that weight loss can be a really effective treatment or way of reducing the severity of obstructive sleep apnea. So based on a GP discretion and where it's indicated, basically. So if a patient is overweight or obese and the GP thinks that recommendations or guidance about weight loss and lifestyle advice is indicated, yeah, equally so would be indicated for someone that has comorbid insomnia at the same time. Alcohol, we think anecdotally, quite commonly used as a sleep aid for insomnia, so self-administered. Yes, alcohol can help people fall asleep at the start of the night. It can lead to more fragmented sleep throughout the night. It can also fragment sleep by making people need to wake up more often to void or use the toilet. So not a very effective sleep aid for insomnia. We know that alcohol can also relax the upper airway muscles and may exacerbate the sleep apnea. So again, not recommended as a treatment in patients with both comorbid insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea, because it can exacerbate the sleep apnea and lead to either more frequent collapse of the upper airway or maybe in some people prolong the periods that the airway is narrowed or closed. Hypnotics was the other one that you mentioned. So again, a lot of people with insomnia using sedative hypnotic medicines for sleep, temazepam, different Z drugs, lots of different sedative and hypnotic medicines that are available. For insomnia, generally, hypnotic medicines are not the recommended first-line treatment for insomnia, as you said a short while before. Although they're very effective at improving sleep in the very short term, if they're used for longer periods of time, some people can start to develop a pattern of dependence on medicine where the initial therapeutic benefit that they felt to their sleep can gradually be replaced by patterns of dependence, withdrawal symptoms when they try to reduce or rebound insomnia symptoms when they try and cease those medicines. We know they're also associated with increased risks of different side effects or different adverse events over time, which we want to avoid. So therefore, they're not recommended as the first line treatment for insomnia. And if they are used, still appropriate in a minority of cases with really severe short-term insomnia, but if they are used, generally recommended for a maximum of about 4 weeks at the lowest dose that's effective. Hypnotic medicines in patients with sleep apnea. There's quite a few clinical trials going on looking at the effect of different hypnotic medicines and hypnotics combined with other medicines in treating the sleep apnea, or at least improving sleep in different subpopulations of patients with sleep apnea. It's really nuanced at the moment and guided by the underlying mechanisms and underlying causes of each patient's sleep apnea. So although it's being tested in research settings in really highly controlled scientific studies, those sorts of interventions for sleep apnea probably aren't quite ready for widespread dissemination into clinical practice just yet, but a lot of ongoing research in that field, which is pretty exciting. Yeah, but generally same recommendations for COMISA as insomnia, that hypnotic medicines wouldn't be recommended as the first line treatment or a long-term treatment for the insomnia. Yeah, hopefully that gives you a bit of information in the landscape of all of the different lifestyle factors and so on, David.
Very important. Do any prescription medications make the problem worse?
There was some research back in the 80s by Christian Guillemot and colleagues showing that certain benzodiazepines might exacerbate symptoms of sleep apnea in certain patients. So they're following those studies in the 80s and a couple of commentaries and whatnot in the scientific literature. I think that led to quite a lot of hesitation in the field about using benzodiazepines in combination with sleep apnea. But as I said, now there's a lot more scientific research exploring these, but in much more refined and targeted populations. So really personalized therapies based on the underlying mechanisms. So a lot of caution initially around benzodiazepines and sleep apnea, but ongoing research in this space that's paving the way for better treatments.
A population group that worries me, Alex, are the younger population with ADHD on medications that are really stimulating, and does it cause insomnia or sleep issues?
Yeah, potentially. Some of the, well, untreated ADHD could definitely be associated with insomnia. A racing mind at sleep is one of the main symptoms or patterns of response that people with insomnia report, like they put their head down on the pillow to go to sleep and immediately their mind springs into action. So some of those sort of patterns might be similar to some mechanisms of ADHD. And there's some research showing that the prevalence of insomnia is quite high in people with ADHD. As for the medications, I'm not sure, and I would need to look into it, David, so exactly what the medicines are. And I would imagine that the exact timing that the medicines are consumed would also have a pretty important part on any secondary insomnia symptom response that's occurring. Yeah.
It's just that the names, you know, Ritalin and dexamphetamine, these sorts of things, you suddenly go, my goodness, would that actually keep them awake? So,
right. Yeah, quite possible. Yes.
Love to hear more about it at some stage. Where does it lead us to now? You've alerted us to the fact that what were previously seen as, if you like, quite separate subsets have a huge overlap in the population. We are now going to start looking for both sleep apnea in patients with insomnia and looking for insomnia in patients with sleep apnea. And your current recommendation is that really you can't tell us which one comes first, assess for both, treat for both. And with the insomnia, the first line is still a sleep psychologist. CBT is still the way to go. And that hypnotics really aren't a role except for very severe insomnia and only to be used short term for no more than 4 weeks. And alcohol is not good medication and not good self-medication.
Yeah, so based on the evidence and the clinical guidelines, that's a good summary of the current state of the literature and the recommendations. Like you say, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is the recommended first line treatment that we have for insomnia. And CBTI can be accessed in lots of different ways. But the sort of gold standard or best practice way to access CBTI is through an appropriately trained psychologist or therapist or other clinician that specializes in sleep. So sleep physicians that specialize or have training in CBTI, and a lot of GPs have training in CBTI and so on. Yeah. Interestingly, when insomnia and sleep apnea co-occur, the insomnia is quite often seen as the secondary symptom. So the assumption being that the untreated sleep apnea leads to respiratory events, airway closures or narrowing. This can lead to awakenings from sleep that can kickstart the insomnia cycle. So the conceptualizing the two in this way sort of leads to the assumption that if we treat the sleep apnea effectively, the insomnia should go away as well, right? If the insomnia is completely secondary to the sleep apnea. And probably in about 30% of patients with both conditions, that's true to some extent. But for most patients, we know that the insomnia really actually, even though if it is initially caused by the sleep apnea, the insomnia can really rapidly develop functional independence. So it can actually start to become a self-maintaining condition. perpetuated by its all of its own psychological and behavioral causes. So even if the sleep apnea is still there, the insomnia might be caused by learned associations or conditioned associations between the bedroom environment or different activities leading up to bed, or people staying in bed, getting annoyed, frustrated, and trying to sleep, and so on. And in that case, if we do treat the sleep apnea with CPAP therapy or other treatments for sleep apnea, the insomnia won't necessarily improve. And that's why we think it's important to provide access to treatments for both the insomnia and the obstructive sleep apnea when they co-occur, because we just don't know yet. We can't provide the tools to identify who has secondary insomnia, or insomnia mostly secondary to the sleep apnea, and who has insomnia that requires treatment, because most people seem to require treatment for the insomnia. That's the current recommendation. Yeah.
Now, what sorts of exercise would you recommend for these sorts of patients, and what time of day?
Yeah, so physical activity, not only important for sleep health, but overall health, obviously. The previous recommendation was to avoid exercise leading up to bed. Now we have more evidence to suggest that exercise immediate or in the lead up to bed is quite okay, as long as it's not super vigorous exercise, like going for a 30K marathon practice or anything. And actually, pragmatically, it's probably more important to encourage people to exercise whenever they can. So maybe the evening time is the only time of day that a lot of people are able to exercise, and it's important to get that exercise in. Lots of different types of exercise, obviously, and different exercise works for different people. So the general recommendation, just not super vigorous exercise in the period immediately before bed. So allow some wind down time, yeah.
Alex, I'm glad you touched on the new research, because I'm still telling people, you know, that the body temperature has to, the core temperature has to drop half a degree before you fall asleep, and don't exercise before going to bed. It's something we've been saying for so long that this is actually quite new.
A lot of it becomes ingrained. Yes, I've seen previous recommendations of don't exercise in the 3 to 4 hours leading up to bed. It's still really important to create a bit of a buffer to wind down and let the body relax before bed. But we think light and moderate exercise in the lead up period is still quite okay, maintaining that, you know, buffer. And again, each person is different, and I think people will understand their own bodies and how their own bodies are, what sort of recovery time is needed. Yeah.
Very good. Now, I'm just going to go into a very quick self-disclosure before I ask you to give us the key messages in summary. Alex, as I had previously mentioned to you many years ago, I had a sleep initiation insomnia and this crazy ability to wake up at the same time most nights, which was 11 minutes past one. And I was really bothered by this insomnia, didn't know what to do about it. But what happened next was that my wife goaded me into getting a sleep study done, which I resisted. When the results came back, I was shocked at the severity and eventually forced into trying CPAP. So I must belong to the very small group of people you mentioned, because a few weeks into using the CPAP, I was beginning to fall asleep very quickly and not waking up in the middle of the night. And I guess even though this is an N equals one anecdote, yeah. It was incredibly powerful for me to understand the connection between the two.
Yeah, that's right. So it sounds like quite a clear-cut pattern that the insomnia symptoms were dependent on the untreated sleep apnea in your case. And more or less, as soon as the sleep apnea was effectively treated, that you were no longer experiencing those difficulties falling asleep at the start of the night or frequent or long awakenings during the night. So yeah, that sounds like a quite a clear-cut case of secondary insomnia. And yeah, you're among probably 30 to 40% of people with COMESA that do show that pattern of response. So insomnia improves to some degree after the sleep apnea is treated. But again, there's a whole continuum. Some people experience a bit of insomnia improvement, but not complete remission. In some people, in a lot of patients with COMESA after starting CPAP, because they already have difficulties falling asleep, or they might spend a long time awake overnight, trying to introduce CPAP into that situation It can lead to more side effects and make things worse. So some patients can see CPAP more as a threat to their sleep because it might keep them awake, or they might be uncomfortable with the mask forcing air into the nose or throat. In that case, we would see a lot of benefit in initially treating the insomnia to improve those symptoms and facilitate a better initial experience with CPAP. So lots of different presentations and different ways of applying appropriate treatment. Yeah.
And thank you for making us aware of how difficult it is to get used to a CPAP device, because there were times in the night when I was about to throw it out my window. Now, over to you to give us some key messages and a summary of this important topic.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, David. So I guess the first thing is to recognize that insomnia and sleep apnea do frequently co-occur. So they're not just completely isolated conditions that occur separately to one another. About 40 to 50% of patients with either condition have both. So that's probably the main take home. The second, we have really brief, standardized and useful tools for GPs to assess for both insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea. So where should GPs find these? They're on the Sleep Health Primary Care Resources, which is a website developed during a Centers of Research Excellence funded program through Flinders University and Bond University, and now owned and maintained by the Australasian Sleep Association. So if you Google for Sleep Health Primary Care Resources, you'll come across this living online guideline, lots and lots of information about insomnia, sleep apnea, COMISA, and also these interactive questionnaires that can be used with patients. And probably the final take home from me is that if both insomnia and suspected sleep apnea or confirmed sleep apnea occur in any patients, the recommendation is at the moment is to provide access to assessment, diagnostic and treatment pathways or options for both disorders. So not just to narrow down on one disorder or the other, but to consider treatment options and talk to patients about treatments for both conditions.
Alex, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. As I said, this topic, when I first saw it, was very close to my heart. And thank you for making us aware that it is a whole lot more common than we ever expected.
Yeah, thanks again, David. Always a pleasure to chat.
Just a quick reminder as we wrap up to encourage you to register for the next webcast, where you can always catch a high-quality lineup of speakers and topics that HealthEd has put together for you. HealthEd webcasts are carefully created to provide high-quality video and audio so that you have the best possible learning experience. It's free, you get CPD points, and it's all delivered directly to the digital device of your choice, wherever you choose to be. Register now at healthed.com.au. You can claim RACGP CPD points for listening to this podcast using the self-claim option. Log into your account on the RACGP website, go to the CPD section and click on self-claim.